Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Steve Nash. Steve Nash is the author of an incredible new book called Virginia Climate Fever: How Global Warming Will Transform Our Cities, Shorelines, and Forests. Steve Nash has been reporting on science and the environment for 25 years or more. He has written for publications that include the New York Times, Washington Post, Bioscience, Scientist, The New Republic, and Archaeology. He's a visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond in Richmond, Virginia. Steve Nash, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
It's great to have you on. It's great as both a Virginian and someone who cares about the future of this planet to have this book that you've put together about how climate change, or I think you have a better term for it. What is it? Climate disruption?
Climate disruption really captures the predicted phenomenon much more clearly.
Yeah, change.
Warming sounds cozy. It sounds like toast and electric blankets, but disruption is what's going to happen to our natural systems and a lot else about the way we live.
It's unusual to have sort of an analysis of what's happened thus far and prediction of what's going to happen for a specific area. It's always about the globe with global warming as well. What has happened thus far in terms of Virginia? Where has the temperature gone, and then where is it likely to go?
Well, I got interested in this as any citizen would, but as a journalist, I got interested in climate change when I began to hear about it. Back in the late 1980s, it was beginning to be implicated in several of the stories I was writing, national stories about environmental topics and economic topics, and also about Virginia. But the problem was we were always talking about it as a global or a hemispheric or a continental phenomenon, because that's the way the climate models deal with the subject usually. And projections have proven to be very accurate at that scale. What's been happening more recently is that climatologists have been able to refine the models, but also they have the use of much more powerful computers. That means that we can look at the picture with much smaller pixels, and we can finally begin to talk about areas of the size of Virginia, or even some of the counties of Virginia, and make sense of the topographic influences that might weigh in the mountains, the river valleys, and of course the coastal regions. So as you've said, that's something that has become available more recently. You also asked about something that interested me initially: what's been happening in Virginia already? And it seemed to me that historically we ought to have very good records and be able to say simply, yes, it's been getting warmer or rainier or something, or it hasn't. What's going on with that? And I was really surprised to learn that we don't know, or we didn't when I started inquiring, know much about what's been happening in recent decades. It's a very confusing picture. The state climatologist didn't really know. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration didn't really know. So that's where I began my inquiries. Can we make sense of what's been happening in recent years? And what I came up with was that according to the climate statistician for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who has since become a consultant, the rate of increase in Virginia is about 0.47 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. That's a rate of 4.7 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature over the course of a century, and the word disruption really applies to a heat increase of that magnitude.
You looked at sort of averages to get a more reliable figure, and you looked at 5-year averages of temperature in Virginia, and there seemed to be a steady increase since the 1970s, since the early 1970s. So this is something that's underway, not predicted for the future, It sounds rather mild, a few degrees a century, and yet we've learned to understand that that has dramatic impacts, correct?
Yeah, it does, and we can work very hard on reining in our greenhouse gas emissions and doing what's needed to adapt to the changes that are coming. We can keep our fingers crossed that the climate will be a little less sensitive rather than a little more sensitive than what the mid-range of climate models project. But the problem with our perception of this is it's going to happen over a period of years, an indefinite period of years. And as you've said, it doesn't seem like much if we're talking about roughly half a degree per decade of change. Well, heck, there can be 30 or 40 degrees of difference between night and day temperatures in Virginia. So it doesn't really register on our senses or on the way we think about climate very much. But when we're talking about the impact on natural systems, we're talking about what happens to the polar glaciers. We're talking about what happens to the 60% of Virginia that is forested. We're talking about what happens to water supplies, and those can be affected very profoundly and in fairly short order. Some of the modeling says that that we could be looking at forest die-offs in Virginia within 10 or 15 years, and some of them bring it in even closer than that.
Yeah, it sounds like not a huge increase, but the scientists you talked to and the numbers you're looking at suggest that Virginia would be as hot as South Carolina by the middle of this century and as northern Florida by the end of this century, and continuing on from there with, I guess, no end in sight. What will happen to Virginia's forests? The majority of the state is forest. What happens to it?
Well, you know, the sort of view that I would like to entertain, that I would like to walk into this conversation with, is one that's sort of a shrug of the shoulders. If it gets warmer and Virginia looks like northern Florida, who could complain too strenuously? People live by the millions in northern Florida, and they seem to do just fine, and so they wear short-sleeve shirts more often, and they drink tropical drinks under palm trees, and it's no big deal. The problem is that those palm trees and all of the very densely textured natural systems that go with them, all of the plants and animals and bugs and the rest of the natural life support systems that we depend on, the agricultural systems included, all of that can't move north into this warmer climate that we're establishing in Virginia at anything like the pace that climate change is coming on. They can't respond to a half a degree of average differences over the course of a decade. It sounds trivial to us, but for them, that's just an average, and so there are spikes of heat and other phenomena that go with it that are going to make it impossible for them to migrate into the state that quickly. The tree cover that we do have, all of the wonderful oak and pine and gum and all of the other forest species that we do have in Virginia now, by the same token, they are not going to be able, perhaps, to stand up to that rather sudden increase in heat and establish new populations of their own species to the north. And what forest ecologists say is that that gap between what can move in, it may take hundreds or a thousand years for something new to move in, and what's going to move out and die off in relatively short order, they refer to that as a big die-off. And that means that instead of forests, we could be looking at some kind of savanna. If it gets hot enough, it won't be hospitable to trees at all, except in small, scattered clumps. We'll have grasslands instead of forests, and that will be the National Climate Office, our federal National Climate Office, has said that that in the Southeast could be one of the most profound changes that we'll see from climate change on the continent, not just the region.
It would certainly be dramatic for the woods of Virginia to be gone. We're speaking with Steve Nash, the author of Virginia Climate Fever. So apart from what's on the ground, what about the sky? Will it be raining more or less, or with more intensity? What do we expect, and what's happened thus far in that regard?
Well, It's a wonderful question to contemplate, because it gives me the chance to introduce the idea of uncertainty. Uncertainty sounds like a frailty of climate projections, but really it's one of the strengths of the way our climate scientists are doing business. When we talk about how hot it's going to get, we're talking about a range of possibilities, not a dead certainty in a certain year, but a range of possibilities over the course of 10 or 15 years. Those possibilities mean that the odds of one thing or another happening are going to increase. It doesn't mean we can walk out on the back porch on a Thursday in the year 2050 and look at a certain kind of day.
Sure.
We can see that most clearly with rainfall. The models that are in most common use, the ones in which we have found to be most reliable, disagree completely with each other. They contradict each other about what's going to happen in the southeastern United States about rainfall. So by the decade of the 2080s, for example, one set of models projects quite a bit more rain, and one set of models predicts quite a bit less rain than what we've experienced in the last 30 years, the average that we've all kind of lived within. So we really don't know. What we can say, though, is that because of the projected heat, even more rainfall may leave us with drier soils, because the evaporation is going to be so much more intense.
Where you did seem to find the most certainty among scientists was in terms of the rainfall and other precipitation coming in more extreme and shorter lasting bursts. And you noted that between 1948 and 2006, there had already been an increase of 25% in so-called extreme precipitation events. Can we expect more storms and less even drizzle of rain across the days and weeks?
Apparently so. That study that you referred to was by the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. They did look back at the record of extreme weather during the time span that you mentioned, and it has already been advancing. Extreme weather means longish periods of no rain, of drought, and short, brief bursts of very intense thunderstorms where outsized amounts of rain are going to fall. So if we're averaging things, which is what we tend to do when we're talking about climate takes place over 30 years rather than what you see out your window. If we're talking in those averages, they can tend to camouflage things in our daily experience. You can have an average rainfall that's exactly what we are used to historically in Virginia, But if it's a series of droughts interspersed with very heavy flooding, you're still within your average, but you have a very different climate. Our agricultural systems, and again, our natural systems, depend on a more or less steady train of rainstorms over a given period of time, especially during growing season. And the confidence level is pretty high among climatologists that what we will see instead is more episodes of extreme weather.
And what about flooding due to the rising of the ocean and the bay and the tidal rivers of Virginia? How is that looking thus far and projections going out?
That's the phenomenon that we are most familiar with in public discourse in Virginia because it's tangible, because our coastal cities are experiencing flooding more frequently, and because sea level rise has been measured beyond doubt for quite a long period of time. Some of this is climate change, and some of it is because our particular part of the Atlantic seaboard is subsiding. If you put those two things together, Virginians are seeing more sea level rise than even other parts of the East Coast. It will continue, and we will have to decide how much of the landscape that we have built upon has to be abandoned, or how much will have to be protected with seawalls and dikes and so forth at a very high price.
You noted that the mayor of Norfolk was already talking about the possibility of abandoning certain parts of that city as just too costly to protect.
Yes, it's a courageous thing for him to do, because all of us, me included, would rather emotionally turn away from this and say it's preposterous. It's too big. It's not part of my experience as a human being. It's not going to happen. But down there, they're getting their feet wet and the undercarriages of their cars wet regularly. They can see what's happening. And he had the political moxie to say, look, we're going to have to start planning for this rather than just passively waiting for catastrophe.
A lot of people remember a book called Misty of Chincoteague about the wild ponies living on Chincoteague Island on the eastern shore of Virginia. Are they going to continue living there indefinitely?
They're having a bit of a tough time already, because the forage that they use, the pastures that that those wonderful ponies eat from, are increasingly invaded by saltwater, and therefore they're dying off, as are some of the forests in the Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge. It is incremental, and it will begin to squeeze their habitat. I can only hope that we'll find someplace else for them to go. They are a good thing to sort of focus on because they're charismatic, beautiful animals. That's what's going to be happening to a lot of other wildlife that's a lot less visible along our natural shorelines. Our wetlands are disappearing now. They're being more and more submerged. As the water gets deeper, the grasses and the aquatic species, the fish, the tiny mollusks and bugs that inhabit those tidal wetlands, they're being inundated and they can't live in that kind of habitat. If there's someplace else for them to move, then they'll do it. If they can survive, they certainly will. The problem for them and for us, however, in Virginia, is that we have given over a lot of our coastal landscape to development in the future. It isn't protected. It can become strip malls and roads and residential areas. Many of us want to live near the water. But since the water's coming the other way, the wetlands will just disappear. We'll try to protect that investment of all of those houses or whatever we built on the shore. And the minute we put up pilings or bulkheads or embankments, the wetlands disappear because there's no place for them to move inland. there are something like 20 or 30 species of fish that we that are economic mainstays of our fishing industry, and they will no longer be able to feed and breed in those areas if the wetlands go away. One federal study has said that within 100 years, sea level rise will come on so fast and development is coming on so fast in the other direction that we may lose all of our wetlands.
Some
careful planning can really help us avoid that.
The numbers that you listed for different species was absolutely staggering. In Virginia, either threatened or endangered, 46% of fish species, 25% of bird species, 46% of reptiles, 43% of amphibians, 28% of mammals, and I guess perhaps not yet 100% of Homo sapiens, but this is absolutely staggering in terms of the potential mass extinction. How is it that people are not up in arms and absolutely devoting every second of every day to combating this danger? I mean, this is beyond anything other than nuclear war that we've had held over our heads.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that figure too. It comes to us from a state agency that is mostly about hunting and fishing, and for me, that makes it all the more credible and poignant. In Virginia, we have natural conservation programs that are staffed with extremely hardworking and effective individuals, and they have done yeoman work over the decades on paltry budgets, trying to keep our natural landscapes and the wildlife that inhabit them relatively intact. But this is the situation we see now as the additional challenge of climate change comes on us. 900 species that are either endangered or threatened or whose populations are diminishing. It reminds me to say, however, that it's easy to look at something this scale and just be paralyzed. But in fact, you know, humans are adaptable in ways that you and I would find congenial. They do plenty that is deplorable and nightmarish, but collectively we have managed ourselves and our landscape through history very, very beautifully sometimes, and maybe climate change will be the issue that brings these other environmental problems to the front burner. As we try to decide how to manage for climate change, maybe we'll become, in Virginia and many other states too, more aware of the damage that we've already created, sometimes willfully and sometimes inadvertently, on the land.
I'd certainly hope so. You cite, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, at one point in your book that people in the United States per capita do about twice as much damage to the environment as Europeans. And then elsewhere later in the book a proposal for change might involve reducing our consumption and greenhouse emissions by 50%, which sounds radical and drastic and impossible to do, and yet living as Europeans live doesn't sound so difficult or horrible. Why is it that we can't make that change?
The figure that you're referring to is about the amount of greenhouse gases that we're emitting into the atmosphere. And yes, we're quite a long ways ahead of Europeans per capita and Japanese per capita and the underdeveloped world, of course, per capita. What we thought of a generation ago as earmarks of a highly advanced and sophisticated civilization, some of that wastefulness has instead become an earmark of things that we'll have to throttle back on to address climate change. You know, every author, as soon as his or her book is published, finds things that that we wish could be rewritten instantaneously.
I've had the experience.
yeah. So one of the things that I think I might have addressed more strenuously in the book is that this isn't necessarily going to be some kind of cataclysmic change. We all feel more realistic and more hard-headed if we say, well, solar power and wind power and other kinds of renewable energy, gee, that's, we're going to have to do it, but it's going to be really, really tough. I woke up one morning recently to read that in Germany, on a Sunday, more than half of the electrical power generated in Germany came from renewables, and that on the average day, 30% of their energy is coming from renewables. Not their energy, excuse me, their electrical energy.
Yeah.
All of that has taken place in about 10 years' time. The people who have been inconvenienced by that shift aren't the average citizens of Germany who are applauding their ability to get these kinds of things done. The only inconvenience has come to the electric power generators. And those power companies, of course, have had to make some adjustments. I think in Virginia and everywhere else in the United States, we could suffer that level of inconvenience to the established power generators just fine. And we could do everything that Germany has done on exactly as fast a schedule, and maybe a lot faster and at a lot bigger scale. Why not? When we look at what we've been able to do on a wartime footing in this country, how we've exerted ourselves and prevailed when we've decided what needs to be done, this kind of problem is manageable. And that's not to say that it's trivial, but it is to say that we needn't scare ourselves into some kind of paralysis. There's a lot of hope and some recent studies out there that say the transition could be relatively easy economically.
Well, we act as if it isn't wartime, but the United States is still spending about $1 trillion a year on war and war preparations, and I would, as no expert, I would hazard to guess that a fraction of that could go quite some distance toward moving us in the direction of clean and sustainable energy.
What a nice peace dividend to finally begin doing something rather than just talking about climate change.
It certainly would be, and I hope that studies similar to yours are being done in states and regions around this country and the world, but this is certainly an incredibly useful tool here in Virginia and a model for other states. The book is called Virginia Climate Fever, How Global Warming Will Transform Our Cities, Shorelines, and Forests. The author is Stephen Nash. Stephen, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
I really appreciate the opportunity. It's been great to talk with you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.